Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to another great edition of the Weekly Pulse. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder, CEO of the Morning Pulse, and your host for the next 60-plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues related to retirement, the markets, technology, personal finance, and so much more. Our contributors are chomping at the bit to share their insights into what's going on, and we're going to be joined by a very special guest. He's the creator and founder of Millennial Money. Mr. Grant Sabatier is going to join us to give you an inside look in what millennials are thinking. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of The Weekly Pulse.
Yeah.
We're going to start things off as we always do. And joining us now for our social media section is Senior Financial Editor for LinkedIn, Mr. Devin Banerjee. DB, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well, Jeff. And you?
I'm doing great. And I guess for the audience's benefit, we saw each other. You know, Devin's been going back and forth between the coasts. So he's kind of bi-coastal now, even though he lives in San Francisco and L.A. He's kind of lives in California. But it was great to see you. Thanks for being a contributor and working on some really cool stuff that I can't wait for the audience to see in 2019. But as I digress, you know, you have been, even though you've been on planes, you have been scouring social media and keeping your pulse, pun intended, on what's going on in that world. So what's top of mind in the financial world?
Yeah, definitely still seeing some great conversations on social media, even though I think people are really getting into the holiday mood slowly. But this week, some interesting stories. One is, you know, the latest segment of the workforce to really struggle with stagnant wages and debt is nurses. So a survey from NYU found that 10 to 14% of nurses are actually taking on second jobs. And again, they're struggling with the stagnant, and this is so strange because there's this nurse shortage in so many major cities around the country, and yet wages are not increasing enough. And the other major factor that nurses attribute this to is student loan debt. So, you know, as we talk about often, but with nurses in particular, they go through additional education and the salaries they receive on the other end are not as, you know, incrementally higher after that additional education as, say, doctors or lawyers or people who get MBAs, for example. And so a great story from Jamie Lee, my colleague, about this report, and she interviewed some nurses and found that, you know, some are trying to pick up extra hours, but others are starting to drive for Uber or Lyft, or she found some selling crafts on Etsy or trying to get consulting gigs. Mm. So just another segment of the workforce that is struggling with these stagnant wages that we see.
Yeah, and you know, we need people. You know, healthcare is something that's so we've talked about on the show in multiple segments that healthcare is vital, especially as we get older. I think it's estimated that healthcare for a retiring couple today is close to $350,000, and that's on a conservative basis. So we need these people to do great work and to support people as they retire and have different maladies. So that's a little disconcerting. Do you think that some of the, you know, I don't know, taking on some additional side work, some side hustle, is a result of people just have other passions, or is it really just due to stagnant wages?
You know, it's certainly possible. The nurses that we spoke with all attributed it to their personal financial condition. They just needed that extra money. Mm-hmm. And you know, they find these side gigs essential, but actually there are so many studies that show that those who take on additional work tend to collaborate less in the hospital or in their healthcare organization. They collaborate less with clinicians, and that patient satisfaction actually suffers. And so this is actually quite a sad situation. I wish it was the point that you touched on, which is, you know, outside passions, but I think it's really driven by their personal financial conditions.
That's a shame.
Yeah. And, you know, regarding this labor market, you might remember a couple of weeks ago, we talked about a story in the Wall Street Journal by Chip Cutter about companies that are starting to that need employees, you know, so bad that they're hiring them sight unseen. Chip had a follow up story this week talking about employers now doing initial phone, you know, screenings where it's actually just a machine on the other end. It's not even someone at the employer. So this approach, you know, enables candidates to schedule their interviews at their convenience, but it also helps employers really speed up their hiring process because there's so many companies desperate for labor in this tight labor market. So, these one-sided interviews leave candidates with zero real-time feedback, no chance to ask questions. And so just another manifestation of this labor market. We've seen so many interesting manifestations of this tight labor market. And this is just another one. It's job interviews by voicemail, basically.
Interesting. Wow. I mean, that's a sign of today's economy, I guess, you know. Sometimes I know I was warned sometimes as a kid to buy something sight unseen or touched, or but, you know, I guess you can do some good vetting through social media platforms and online. So kudos to those who have figured it out. And hopefully some of us out there can catch up on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, speaking of the economy, two more stories I'll touch on that really sparked a lot of conversation this week. The first is a study from the Brookings Institute where it found that U.S. cities, the large U.S. cities, so those with populations over a million people, accounted for actually 72% of all employment growth since the financial crisis a decade ago. So it's this really lopsided economic recovery in the U.S. Small cities have really struggled to bounce back. Employment in rural areas, unfortunately, is actually below the pre-recession rates. And, you know, a lot of factors here at play, but, you know, the tech industry's really rapid growth in the recent decade has contributed, I think, a lot to this widening divide. And so, you know, the Brookings Institution did think about what might help programs that, you know, boost digital skills and education in technology in less populated regions, or policies that help people move to other parts of the U.S. These could certainly help. But so far, a very lopsided economic recovery in the U.S. And then another economy report that actually today, which is Thursday, we're recording. I thought this was a bombshell. So everyone's starting to think about Brexit again. Remember, it was the summer of 2016 when the referendum occurred, and it was such high chatter about it. And then it got quiet, you know, as they started thinking about how the rubber actually meets the road and how the deal will look. Well, a lot of chatter coming back because obviously, in March of this coming year is when Brexit is actually slated to occur. So official figures today from the UK government, which is a pro-Brexit government, actually found that the economy could shrink in the UK up to 3.9%, almost 4%, after 15 years with Brexit compared with staying in the European Union. That's a massive figure if you think about it. And a Brexit with no deal, meaning no arrangement to sort of continue some ties with the European Union, could shrink the economy by almost 10%, this study found, from the UK government. So this today on Thursday on social media is just creating a ton of chatter. Again, with Brexit, which was kind of a political issue, you get people on both sides of the issue with very strong views. But I think people should not overlook this, because these figures, you know, up to 4% shrinkage or up to 10% shrinkage without some kind of EU deal are some really, really serious figures.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I don't. Obviously, I've never negotiated trade deals, but there's a lot. I don't think either of us have. Yeah. Although I think you're probably more qualified than I am to do something like that. But you know, there's a lot of things that have to be worked out, as you said. And you know, I've been reading a lot of stories online as well, and there's potential people leaving the UK, going elsewhere for seeking jobs, especially tech jobs or newer economy jobs. And I think, you know, shifting from the euro to the pound or back to the pound, you know, there's currency, there's trade agreements that have to be worked out. And, you know, this was kind of sold, if you will, quote unquote, to the British people. And I think as, you know, this is ultimately going to be a long-term good thing. And now, you know, based on what was articulated, there could be some concerns, at least in the short run, maybe in the longer run, that some of those things may not come to fruition. So, you know, I know there was a push at one point to go to another referendum. Referendum. You know, I'm not sure how that, you know, obviously I don't follow UK politics as closely, but I'm not sure how that kind of has worked out, or if they're really going to go down this road. But yeah, obviously, you know, these little agreements, even here in the U.S., when you're negotiating trade deals and tariffs, and these have impacts to.
They have real implications. Yeah.
Absolutely, and I think sometimes people's egos get in the way on all both sides of an issue, and that can really hurt average people who need to save, need to put their kids through college, put food on the table, really hurt small business, which are the lifeblood of our economy and probably of many others.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And perhaps this sort of reveals my opinion a bit on an issue like Brexit. But yeah, you know, a lot of people have these strong nationalist feelings or nationalist pride, which is great. But when they make decisions like this, I think they just need to understand these types of implications, because again, these numbers are really severe for the economy in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Devin, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us a little bit early. I know tomorrow is a real busy day for you, so we appreciate you coming on early, sharing your insight, because it is one of our more popular segments, and appreciate you doing that. And I wish you a wonderful, restful weekend. And no matter where you're traveling next week, have a safe travel and enjoy yourself.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Take care, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Welcome back. And now it's time for our tech segment. Joining me is Ms. Natalie Walter. She's the technology reporter for The Motley Fool. Hi, Natalie. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good.
You have a good
I had a great Thanksgiving break, and now, I'm back to the grind.
Yeah, back to the grind. Well, good to always chat with you. It may have been a Thanksgiving holiday, but you know, technology never sleeps. So, what's top of mind for you as you're kind of covering the news and technology?
Yeah, an interesting story I've been looking at that I think fits in well with the holiday season is that Amazon opened a warehouse brick and mortar store in Soho in New York, and I haven't been yet, but I'm really excited to go this weekend. And the whole idea with this store is that Amazon stocked it with only products that have 4 stars or above on its website. So it's supposed to be the best of the best of Amazon. And I've just been reading some reviews of it, and it seems like a lot of people aren't impressed with it and think that it kind of looks cheap and like they just sort of threw things together, and it's not a well laid out store, and it really does just look like a warehouse. So it's almost like the shopper is a warehouse worker and just going in and, you know, picking items to fill their order. And it's just, obviously it's ironic that Amazon is opening up brick and mortar stores, considering, you know, they caused a lot of brick and mortar stores sales to plummet.
I don't think
that irony is lost on anybody.
Yeah.
And they already have,
I
was just going to mention, as you already probably know, they already have bookstores open that are brick and mortar. Those have been out a few years. And they keep opening more bookstores. So this is their sort of second venture into brick and mortar.
Very interesting. You know, I think there's a high mark when Apple was rolling out its Apple stores many, many years ago. I know they planned that out meticulously. You know, Steve Jobs was very meticulous in everything that he did for Apple. And I know that was very planned out. Not to say that the Amazon concept was not well laid out, but it's kind of hard when that benchmark is so high with Apple. So maybe they decided to go in the other direction. Who knows?
Right. And they also have, you know, sort of a random Amazon product set up in the Whole Foods stores where you can look at Amazon products in the Whole Foods stores. And I always thought that was a little bit random and just seemed disorganized to have a random electronics display in Whole Foods. And I know it makes sense because, you know, more people will get to, you know, try out an Amazon product at the Whole Foods store. Even if they don't buy it at the Whole Foods store, maybe they'll go home and buy it online. But yeah, I think there's something to be said about maybe curating it a bit better. And I don't know. Would you go shop in the Amazon store? Does that excite you, or would you rather just buy it online?
Honestly, I try to stay away from crowds. I prefer, unless I'm buying clothing, I think, although my wife likes to buy clothing online, I prefer to go in and buy something and touch it and feel it. But that being said, if it's got a lot of crowds, I'll definitely shy away from it. But I think it's very ironic, as you brought up, that I agree. It's completely ironic that, you know, they're creating a brick and mortar store when their whole thesis is, you know, doing everything online and cultivating that type of retail culture. But, you know, I guess it remains to be seen. Will the consumer be turned off? I mean, there are other businesses that have brick and mortar that have kind of followed Amazon and do electronic, you know, Walmart and Target are trying to beef up their online presence. And so they're going the other direction. But who knows? Who am I to judge?
Right. And I do like the idea of, you know, it being their top products. Like, that does seem fun to look through for me, even if it isn't well organized. But I think it would be more something I went into for fun for one time. And then, you know, then it's not worth the subway ride for me anymore. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
I think you bring up an interesting point. I know we've talked about this several times, but curation. And I don't know if this is on your radar screen for an article, but curation of content. We've got Netflix and other providers creating hundreds, if not thousands, of shows and selling hundreds, if not thousands, of products. But the curation and the presentation of that stuff is really important, because you have to be able to sort through that stuff in order to find it. And if you can't find it, you can't buy it, you can't sell it.
Right. It's not good enough to just have a good product or good products to offer. And I think that's really important to be able to show people, to curate ideas specifically for each person. And it's hard to do that in a brick and mortar store. You know, it's just kind of this random assortment of items, and they can't curate them for each person. So I guess the middle ground with that is they picked out their top rated products, hoping that will appeal to everybody. But I mean, looking at pictures of it, like I said, I haven't actually been yet, but it does look like a very random assortment of electronics, greeting cards, books, toys, games,
interesting.
Just sort of a mishmash. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I guess more to come on that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know if you have time for another story, but I know we talk a lot about data and technology, and I just saw an interesting short clip today about how China's population is actually more open to sharing their data than people in the U.S. And I think that's really going to help tech companies in China.
Very interesting. You know, I was reading something. I don't know if it ties into this, but I know that Google Google employees were really up in arms regarding, I guess, the search engine in China, and kind of protested or wrote a letter that it did not fly with the values that Google had espoused. And I wonder if, you know, that's with the censorship. But it doesn't surprise me, just back to your story, it doesn't surprise me that people in China would be more comfortable with sharing their data, just given the type of society that they live in. You know, they already have kind of consented to some other things, so maybe it doesn't fall far from their philosophy.
Yeah, it says they're willing to share medical records, and, you know, they're accessing their bank account from, you know, any device, and it's just such a different look from the U.S. right now, because right now it feels like the U.S. is in turmoil. You know, it seems the past 10 weeks or so, we've always had a data privacy story to talk about, and people are really upset about it, and regulations are increasing. So it's interesting to see another country sort of in the opposite direction of us.
Yeah, it's, like I said, almost polar opposites in terms of the philosophy. And you know, it's given me great pause. I like technology, but it has given me great pause. These, you know, I think there was a Dunkin' Donuts breach recently, a Dunkin' Donut perks, and so a lot of information there was mishandled. You know, I definitely am concerned with my data being out there, and I try to protect myself, but there's only so much you can do. But it is really interesting to see the diametrically opposed society like China. And people feel okay with it. I guess it doesn't surprise me, honestly, Natalie.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure some tech companies might want to head over to China now from the U.S.
But, yeah, I mean, I think Facebook and Facebook should probably lead the way, and Google and others. I mean, I definitely see the great opportunity there for them to mine the data. I think the thing that's often lost for many people is not only do investors want subscribers to go up, but also that cultivation and curation of that data, whether it's actual data from the actual consumer or if it's just sentiment and demographics, I think that's mm-hmm. a value too, I think, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. And there's just so much data that can be collected in China, considering they have 1.4 billion people.
Yeah.
That's just so much bigger than any other country. And the fact that the people there aren't too concerned about what they're sharing, I mean, that's just a gold mine for companies like Alibaba that are working very hard to collect that data and to use it to their advantage.
Absolutely. Well, Natalie, always a pleasure. Always appreciate your insight. And looking forward to continuing the conversation next week. But until then, wish you a very restful weekend, and we'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks so much, Jeff. Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye. Welcome back, everyone, and now it is time for our market segment, and we've got the three amigos back. Yeah, there's a little bit of a break because of the holiday. Joining me now, the lead anchor for the TD Ameritrade Network, Mr. Oliver Rennick.
Hola,
¿cómo está? And we've got the principal for Delphi Digital, Kevin Kelly, and of course, Mr. Money Alignment himself, investment advisor George Grumbacher. Hey guys, how are you?
Hello. Great.
Bonjour. So, Oliver, I want to start with you. Before we get to an assessment of the market, congratulations to the TDA network, TD Ameritrade Network, celebrating 1 year on the air, 1.82 million unique visitors, the really first of its kind network over the top.
Thanks,
congratulations,
man.
Buddy.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. And, hey, Mr. Snyder had some hits on there, too, so thanks for being a part of it.
It's my pleasure. I hope I was able – hope I didn't drive away the viewers. You guys probably would have had, like, 9 million viewers had I not been on there.
Well, you're officially on Amazon Fire, too. No, I appreciate it. That means a lot. Thank you. It was a pretty exciting accomplishment to just keep grinding and wait for more and more folks to find the value in the content. That's what's happening. So it's exciting to see that sort of the vision is being verified over time.
I was going to say, TD Ameritrade, you guys bring a very unique assessment of the market. You outlined it a little bit in the previous 2 weeks ago when you talked about – you wrote a nice piece on this. So what's your assessment? What's happened this week? Give us the rundown.
For sure. In most, headline-grabbing event this week, of course, was Fed Chair Jay Powell, right? Changed the language pretty dramatically, turned perceivably pretty dovish. Market loved it. Market rallied. But my takeaway from it is that there's still some issues here for the equity market in terms of just kind of a new environment that we continue to really be in. And it really is for real this time is the, I think, easiest logical case to make, which is that even if you have an accommodative Fed, it's not the panacea that it was for the past 7 years for all of the market's ailments, and rather any ailment that comes around. Just because you have now, almost traditional, not traditional because we've never really been in a post-QE environment like we're in, but kind of classical late cycle type of behavior that happens as economies mature that is not always most favorable to the stock market. It can be favorable, but it generally leads to a degree of smaller returns on average. So you have that you're kind of battling just thematically. And on top of that, we have obviously some of the specific risks, the tariff, the trade stuff, and all that that affects sentiment. But really what it comes down to is, as we've talked about before, stocks go up, either multiple expands or earnings go up. The expectations that earnings are going to go up over the next year, but at a slower pace. And the Fed does nothing to really change that. You could argue with a few logical leaps that clarity of a Fed outlook might cause companies to spend a little bit more, which is kind of the idea. But in terms of a real, repricing of how quickly companies are supposed to grow, that's not what happened this week. What happened this week is that the market felt good about how quickly the Fed is going to tighten things up. Problem is they're still tightening things up, and there are other means by which bond yields will continue to climb outside of the Fed's activity. That's only really one part of the bond market. You still have inflationary forces. You still have, perception. You have a balance sheet, very importantly, which means new supply coming into the market. So if you're of the belief that volatility in stocks has been basically precipitated, if not created, by higher interest rates, then this week didn't really do a whole lot to change that story either, ironically enough. It might have meant that Fed funds rate is not going to jump up very quickly and very high, but there's still plenty of reason to believe that sort of the bond bear market that's taking shape will continue to offer alternatives to stocks. And that's basically a complex way of saying we have to basically wait to see how quickly those other type of natural economic developments happen. So, you know, for me, there's not a whole lot that really changed. I think the market might be a little bit too backward, you know, a little bit too kind of used to its 2014, 2015 mentality. That's kind of what we've been talking about thematically here.
Really interesting. Kevin, I want to bring you in here. You're a former equity strategist, now covering the crypto. Can you first kind of dovetail what Oliver's talking about in the equity markets and then take it into the crypto volatility we've seen, especially the Bitcoin, just to point them out a little bit, you know, kind of having their price kind of cut significantly, value cut significantly. What's your take on all this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Oliver makes a lot of really good points, you know, and I think there are some parallels you can draw to what's going on in the crypto markets. I mean, you've seen crypto prices over the last really, you know, 4 or 5 weeks or so, taking another like lower. Again, you're continuing to see some of this bubble activity that has deflated over 2018 continue to play out. We do get these mini kind of relief rallies, but we think there's still, you know, a lot of selling pressure. So we don't think necessarily the bottom might be in yet. We're getting closer. But one of the things that Oliver talked about, which I wholeheartedly agree with, is as you get into these later cycle, and as across asset classes, you tend to see, you know, a pickup in volatility. So actually crypto prices, you know, Bitcoin's been relatively, you know, before this 4 to 5 week period, actually the volatility had dropped pretty significantly and was arguably almost comparable to some of these more kind of riskier asset classes, you know, like emerging market stocks. But as you continue to get later into the cycle, as the Fed continues, you know, on the rate path, Oliver, I won't reiterate what he said because I agree, like I said, wholeheartedly with what he's talking about, but I don't think the crypto markets will operate in isolation. I think if you see volatility really pick up in the equity space, which is what you would expect as you get later into the cycle, I think you continue to see some volatility creep over in the crypto markets. For all else kind of held equal, you know, besides the fact that this is an extremely new and experimental technology, so you'd expect it to be more volatile in general. I think the idea that, you know, volatility in crypto will decline as it picks up in other asset classes, just simply, you know, you can't really reconcile that.
Yeah. So I would say if you're an institutional investor, a pension fund, an endowment foundation, or just a fund manager, you've got the resources to kind of play it out. But George, I want to come to you. My mother called me this week. She always calls me. We always talk just to tell me how much she loves me, but which is a great thing. I love my mother. But she also has some concern about the volatility. And I want to get your assessment of what we're seeing because you're out there talking to every man or every person, every woman, every dog, cat, whatever the right terminology is, and get your assessment on this market and what you're seeing as well.
Well, it's been interesting over the past 17 or 18 years where the only legitimate alternative to invest money has been the stock market. And so when you start talking about interest rates going up, I think that becomes attractive to a lot of folks who are worried about volatility, who are more conservative, don't necessarily want to put their money in equities. So I did a little bit of research and I discovered that back in 1981, you could get a CD that paid over 15%. And I know that that's an outlier. I'm sure there's a lot of folks out there who wouldn't mind seeing interest rates go up a little bit so that buy a CD bank, just get a safer place to get a decent rate of return. So I think that people are certainly interested in that, and that's been a topic of interest, and people are curious what's going to happen with the Fed.
Yeah, well, I think my mother, one of the things she's worried about is monthly income, so guaranteed monthly income. She's not worried, but you know, that's a conversation that we're having in the retirement industry is how do you take what you have and convert it to monthly income? And I have been reading studies or surveys where fixed index annuities have actually seen tremendous sales. I don't know how those sales are made, what information is being provided to the general public, but that's a direction that I think a lot of people are going.
Yeah, well, if you Google annuity, you're going to get a lot of really great information about it and a lot of terrible information about it. And an annuity is not a good thing or a bad thing. But when you dig down into the actual product itself and from whatever company it's issued by, that's where the devil is in the details. Yeah. And that's what will make a great product or allows you one are the fees and the expenses, the M&E charges and everything else. So it demands an educated consumer.
Absolutely. So we have about a minute left. Guys, we haven't done this in a while, but I want to talk football real quick. George, want to get your assessment of the of your team, the Arizona Cardinals. I'm going to go right down the line. We'll start with George. We'll go to Kevin, and we'll finish up with Oliver on the NFL football season.
Okay, let me spend some. I got some time to Google here. Hold on.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Sure, go sure, ahead, sure. George.
This is one of those times where I'm gonna be an original homer and say, you know, the Vikings still have a chance. The Cardinals, we're building for the future, and that new quarterback of ours has some real arm talent, but. Kevin?
Nice.
I mean, for the first time in literally almost two decades, I can proudly say that I am a strong LA Rams fan, all the way back to the best show for early 2000s. So I will sit here in all of its glory and say that I think the Rams got a real, real shot.
Well, that's absolutely, because the look last night, the New Orleans Saints did not look too great. And lastly, Oliver, I'm going to come to you. I'm not sure who your home team is, but you have a good feel for sports. What are you thinking in the NFL season?
I'm thinking that I'm going to sit and wait until the Niners are good again.
Right, yeah. You might be okay. Waiting at least another year.
Sell and hold.
Sell and hold.
That's to
all right.
Hold.
I like all
right.
It.
All right, guys. Well, great having you all back. Cool. I want to wish you all a good weekend. Oliver, have a great rest of the day in terms of your show. And, guys, we'll talk to you all next week. Take care.
Thanks, bro.
Welcome back, everyone. We've got a very special guest in studio today. Joining me now is Grant Sabatier. He is the president, owner, establishment. Let me go again. Founder is founder better.
Founder, creator, better. Creator. Founder, okay. Whatever's easiest.
Thank you. I always fuck up the beginnings. Here we go. Three, as you know. 3, 2, 1. Welcome back, everyone. We've got a very special guest. We've got the creator and founder of Millennial Money, Mr. Grant Sabatier. Hey, Grant, how are you, bud?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing? How was your Thanksgiving?
Thanksgiving was nice. Went down, spent some time where I grew up in D.C. and still adjusting to the New York weather, but yeah, had a great time.
I think we're all adjusting to the New York weather. What I want the audience to hear, talk a little bit about your story, but then you really have some great insight into the generation that is known as millennials. So before we get into the millennial generation, would you mind just sharing a little bit about your great story? I think it's awesome, and you've got a lot of great stuff that you've done over the last few years, especially in this year, and you've got stuff planned in 2019, so I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, so you know, my story begins at 24. I was living back home with my parents. I had $2.26 left to my name. I'd bounced around a number of different jobs after college and never kind of found that right fit. I got laid off twice. And so I found myself living back at home, and they said that I could crash for 3 months. And by month two, I had sent out over 200 resumes really into the abyss, and realized that I needed a entirely new skill set if I was going to be able to move forward. So at the time, I was doing a search on my phone and I saw a Google mobile ad, and I quickly learned that you could make 10 to 20% of media spend by managing Google campaigns, and that you could get certified from Google for free, and that there was demand for that career. And so I spent, you know, the next couple of weeks watching YouTube videos, going through Google AdWords University, ended up getting Google certified, applied to a digital marketing agency, and ended up getting the first job that I applied to. So after, you know, applying to over 200 jobs, it was at that point that I read a book that completely changed my life, Your Money or Your Life by Vicky Robin and Joe Dominguez. And the simple takeaway, the really transcendent question is, what are you willing to trade your life for? You know, how much money are you willing to trade your life for? And, you know, that was a hugely profound message for me. And I realized, you know, at that moment, A, that I hadn't been taking money seriously, and that B, I didn't want to work, you know, for the next 40 years in a cubicle. So I set the really unrealistic goal at the time of trying to make $1 million and retire as quickly as possible. You know, over the next 5 years, it took me 5 years, 3 months, and 6 days to get there.
Who's counting?
But during that time, I read over 400 books about personal finance, entrepreneurship, and investing. I launched multiple companies, multiple side hustles. You know, literally spent pretty much all of my time trying to reach financial independence. I learned a ton, not only about money, but about myself along the way. And then once I reached financial independence in 2015, I started millennialmoney.com, which since then has reached a little over 15 million visitors and continues to grow, and made it really my life's mission to help others make more money so they can live life on their own terms. And yeah, that's pretty much my story in a nutshell. I've got a book coming out early next year that I'm gearing up for. It's called Financial Freedom. It comes out with Penguin Random House in 13 different languages all across the world. And yeah, I'm deep in that process and excited to take that book around the world.
Absolutely. And I love, you know, when you and I were talking a couple of weeks ago, you know, it's all about empowerment. And I, you know, I love that message that you have: financial independence, empowerment, empowering people to do what they want to do and believe in what they want to believe and do that, take that on for themselves. And I love that message.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think really money only matters if it helps you live a life that you love. And one of my core parts of my mission is that I think that, you know, everyone should have access to that opportunity. And thankfully, it's never been easier in history to make more money and live life on your own terms. And there are more and more success stories and more paths. You know, there's really no longer one path, you know, to wealth, the, you know, bear down and grind it out for 40 years, saving 10% of your income. There's so many different options today. And that's the cool thing, because we're living in a really, really exciting time. And I'm excited to teach people that path.
So, and I love that. And, you know, I want to get into the millennial generation, because I think this is, you know, we always paint in our society with a very broad brush. You know, Gen X is this, Gen Y is this, men are this, women are that. And I think in some ways, you know, you see as many studies as I do about the millennial generation. They don't do this, they do that. But there are some real misconceptions there. And I wonder, you know, you've got the pulse, if you will, on the generation. If you could share a little bit of insight into what you've learned about your generation.
Yeah, totally. So I think it's important to note that millennials can pretty, you know, we're all so different, so varied, such a diverse, the most diverse generation in U.S. history. But I think there's two distinct millennial personas. And the first one is kind of the older millennial, and the second one is the younger millennial. So the older millennial, you know, anyone who's, you know, 27 to 35 right now is in a very different position than those who are between kind of 22 and 27. And I think it's important to divide them up that way, because, you know, we're a pretty big generation, and, you know, we function quite differently. You know, the older millennials right now are saving about 5.5% of their income. So when, you know, a 5.5% savings rate. So in terms of, you know, savers, while not saving a lot, they're certainly saving more than the average American. The average savings rate is around, I believe, 3.2% right now. And so thankfully, older millennials are starting to make more money. A vast majority, I think it's something like 70% of millennials, both younger and older, now have a side hustle. And that's super exciting to see, because more and more people are, you know, whether it's freelancing or participating in some way in the gig economy, side hustling is an incredible way not only to make more money and build new skills, but it's also really empowering as well. And that's the cool thing. I think there's this really intense entrepreneurial spirit that both younger and older millennials have. And the cool thing is, like, older millennials, now that they've been doing it for a couple of years, you're starting to see more millennials take the leap into full-time entrepreneurship, full-time, you know, sort of gig economy work. And the great thing is that even though, as by and large, we're actually really behind our parents in terms of how much money we're making relative to how old we are. And unfortunately, you know, the average millennial still has over $30,000 in student loan debt. And so, you know, that's obviously something that's holding, you know, some people back. But it's in my opinion, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in student loan debt. You know, a lot of people now I see using that as kind of an excuse to not invest. And the exciting thing is I'm seeing more and more success stories of people who are going out, focusing on making more money ultimately to pay down that student debt and getting rid of that huge burden. So overall, I think, you know, the sentiment of the generation that I see is incredibly optimistic. You know, often in the media, you see an over-focus on the student loan debt and how everyone's behind. But the ones that I talk to are super excited about their ventures. You know, there's a lot of people going out and, you know, defining success for themselves. That's the cool thing. That's what makes me happy is seeing so many people being like, you know, I'm going to go, you know, kind of live life and try to live life on my own terms for a while. Obviously, that's easy to do when you're 23, 24, don't have kids, than, you know, the older millennials who are starting to have more children and buy their first homes. But by and large, I remain extremely bullish on my generation in terms of their ability to be flexible and ultimately, you know, make money and live life on their own terms.
That's awesome. And I agree. I mean, I think, you know, the media and we always tend to get hung up on one aspect or two aspects of things, but you're right. There's so much more. Everyone's unique. Everyone's got their own issues that they're dealing with. And, you know, it's very important to kind of take people individually rather than kind of paint them with a broad brush. So, Grant, we're going to have to leave it there, but, you know, I'd like to invite you back maybe, to be a regular contributor on the show. We'd love to have you, join us and kind of check in every week about what's going on with millennials, how you see it, how they see it. I think it'd be really interesting for the audience.
Yeah, man, let's do it. I'm looking forward to it. I really, really appreciate the conversation.
Awesome. Well, Grant, always awesome talking with you. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
Thanks,
you too.
Bye-bye. So I can bust like a bubble. Captain and Lone Beach together. Now you know you in trouble because ain't nothing but a G-bang, baby. Welcome back, and now it's time for our personal finance segment. And joining me on the line, Mr. Jacob Passy. He's a personal finance reporter with Dow Jones Market Watch. Hi, Jacob. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. It was good. I actually went to the parade and froze my butt off because it was incredibly cold here in New York.
Yeah.
But it was fun.
Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you had a good time and glad to talk with you. You know, I think many of our audience probably know by now as they're listening to the podcast that the Marriott organization had a significant data breach. You're covering the story. How do you, you know, why don't you weigh in on this?
Yeah, so for starters, some of the details about the breach, it's expected that around 500 million guests' information was affected. The hackers gained access to the Starwood reservation system at Marriott, and so among the information they got access to includes people's names, their addresses, phone numbers, and even passport numbers. So, you know, a lot of information is vulnerable. A lot of people are vulnerable. It's one of the larger breaches that's occurred this year. And, you know, given how many people it's affected, you know, a lot of the common sense stuff that you should do in terms of a data breach applies here. You know, if you've stayed at a Marriott property or any of its sister properties, Starwood, Residence Inn, you should consider freezing your credit. That's free at all three major credit bureaus here in the U.S. And so by freezing or locking your credit, it means that, you know, if someone tries to use your information to apply for a credit card or a loan, you'll be notified and they'll be prevented from doing so. You also should sign up for credit monitoring. You can either opt for, you know, if you've been implicated in this breach, Marriott is offering free credit monitoring services to those people, but you may also want to sign up for your own identity theft and credit monitoring service from somewhere like LifeLock.
Hey, Jacob, you know, in these cases, does Marriott notify people that their information has been breached? Is that how it would work? They would, they have a responsibility.
People,
to do that?
People will likely be notified. That being said, it's affected millions of people. And in a lot of cases with these breaches, you know, they, you know, given how many people are affected. It may take time for them to notify everyone. They're still, I think, sorting through to some extent exactly who and how many people were affected. And also sometimes with a breach like this, you know, they may learn that more people were affected than initially thought. So, you know, especially if you've stayed at any so far it's just affected people who went through the Starwood reservation system. But you know, you don't know, we don't know fully exactly how many people are affected. So if you've stayed at a Marriott, it's a good idea to take action now. And, you know, we're kind of getting to this zone where so many of these major data breaches are happening. We had Equifax last year, you know, given how common this is becoming, you know, people may want to just start doing some of these things to begin with. You know, my colleagues here at MarketWatch have been writing stories for the past year about, you know, the fact that we're kind of in this world now where you just kind of have to expect that you're going to get your data stolen. And so you need, you know, freezing your credit reports, things like that. Taking those proactive steps will protect you when that happens.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think it's a matter of if. I think it's a matter of when. And having the steps that you're articulating handy, and you know how to react to it. You know, it's a two-way street. The organization has to react to the breach, but also the customers have to somehow react. And you articulated, you know, letting, you know, Equifax and Experian and, you know, the various credit agencies know about this so that they can monitor, letting your credit card organizations know, et cetera. I mean, that's all things that you can do and be proactive about, because it's going to happen. And there's also one I was reading earlier this morning when I was doing the morning polls. Dunkin' Donuts announced a breach as well. So
exactly. And one interesting thing with this breach, because I'm working on a separate story looking at just kind of, you know, the way that travelers need to protect themselves. And one thing that came up was an interesting thing in this case is that it's not just that people's credit cards might be vulnerable, it's also that their rewards points might be vulnerable. And we've been seeing that more and more. Rewards points and flyer miles for different airlines and hotels are extremely lucrative to sell on the dark web. And so people are trying to gain more and more access to that. So, you know, in this case, don't just check if you stayed in a Marriott and you're a Marriott Rewards member, don't just check your credit card and bank statements. Also check your rewards portal to make sure that you have the number of rewards points that you should have.
Yeah, very, very important. Those things are like currency too. Interesting. We were earlier in the show, we talked to Natalie Walters, a tech reporter from The Motley Fool, and she was talking about you know, how people in China are more comfortable with the sharing of their data, for example, health data, with entities. But here in the U.S., I mean, you know, obviously we don't want to share any of our information if we don't agree to it. And, you know, I would imagine that, you know, when you're writing about these things, I mean, you've got some thoughts on this too.
Totally. Yeah. I think, you know, different cultures have different approaches to personal information. You know, in China, you know, folks are just subject to so much more censorship and, you know, kind of, I don't want to say Big Brother type behaviors, but you know, they definitely are monitored more closely, their web activity, things like that. And so, you know, perhaps the willingness to share data comes from that, because they're used to being watched over in their, you know, everyday behaviors online and things like that. And that's why, you know, it's important to, you know, when you travel and whatnot, to keep that in mind. You know, when you go to a foreign country, you know, your web activity and things like that might be monitored by government watchdogs. And you want to make sure that that you take steps to protect yourself. You know, I think that, you know, here in the U.S. we're a bit more private about all sorts of things, including financial matters. And I think that's advisable. But you also shouldn't let that sense of privacy, you know, you don't want to get tripped up by that. You know, just because you haven't shared information, just because you think you haven't shared information, doesn't mean someone hasn't gained access to it. So, you know, the false sense of privacy can also be, you know, kind of a pitfall for some people, I think.
Absolutely. Well, Jacob, thanks for the great reporting, great work. We look forward to seeing your article and your follow-up on this very important matter. And unfortunately, like I said, it's not a matter of if for most Americans, it's a matter of when. So on that note, on that poor sad note, have a great weekend. Give us give Allie our best, and we'll talk to you very soon.
I will. All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome back, everyone. And now it's time to see what is going on Capitol Hill. And joining me are our legal eagles, Mr. David Levine and Kevin Walsh. They are of Groom Law Group, or I should say from Groom Law Group. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
We're doing well. Thanks for having us on. It's always exciting this time of year in D.C. as everyone races towards year end and the end of the Congress.
Yeah, well, good to talk with you, Kevin. Thanks for joining us. And David, you know, Kevin kind of teed it up for you. There's a lot going on, even in this lame duck session.
Yes, there is. Today we're going to talk about two things, Jeff. First, we're going to talk about the Retirement Savings and Other Tax Relief Act of 2018, in other words, known as the House Bill of Pension Grab Bag Items that was unveiled right at the end of Thanksgiving holiday. And we're also going to talk about the Multi-Employer Plan Super Committee a little bit.
Awesome.
So,
awesome.
We have to be honest. We have no idea if any of this is going to pass. If you listen to the different comments from different members, the odds don't seem great at times, but others think it is. So we figure we might as well tell people where this stands. But no matter what, this does tee us up for the next session. Because as we talked last week, there's stuff coming in 19. And one way or another, a lot of the things we're talking about now will be back in 2019. So I'm going to talk for a little bit about the, we'll just call it the House bill, rather than the full mouthful of the name. And basically, it looks a lot like pieces of the Family Savings Act and pieces of RESA, but not everything. And the sort of history of it, according to the public reports, was that this is something that was discussed by the House Republicans and the Senate Republicans, but the Democrats have come out and said, we didn't know anything about this. And what has, so in a world where the House will be coming led under Democratic leadership, as we talked about last week, it has kind of landed with mixed reaction, is a nice way of putting it. And there are things in here that I have already engendered response and from a number of folks. For instance, there's the Lifetime Income Disclosure Act changes that we're trying to get about how your account balance turns into an annuity. The simple answer is there are still many groups. There was already a comment letter that went in from a number of the trades, a number of service providers, that actually sort of divides the annuity versus the non-annuity provider population. And there's people saying, we want a different version of this, about like how your account will be described as lifetime income. So you can already see a little bit of a splitting of the industry.
Yep.
It does include some of the key RESA provisions about the cap, eliminating the 10% cap on automatic enrollment, that we think is pretty widely accepted. And it also includes some of the 870.5 required minimum distribution relief. In other words, people don't have to be as focused on it for people with balances under $50,000. So there are some things that people like. The problem is it doesn't include a lot of the things that were very carefully negotiated, because there are things that a Republican wants, Democratic wants, and there's some that are universal wants, and people are still working on it. And as a result, it leaves us in a place where, unless people suddenly say, we just want to move something, it may make it hard for things to go forward. We'll have to see. And also there's the fact that Senator Majority Leader McConnell has sort of been pretty public saying what his priorities are, and retirement at this point doesn't seem to be at the top of the list. Plus, we have that entire shutdown thing we talked about last week. So that's out there still waiting. So the quick and dirty answer is it's another item on the table. And as we've said before, there's a million bills with the word retirement, enhancement, savings out there. And each of them have different things. And this is another one. Will this get us across the line? It doesn't seem like it, but who knows? We'll have to see. Kevin, you want to talk about any other comments or the Pension Super Committee?
Yeah, thanks, David. I think you hit on a lot about that bill. Just kind of want to highlight one other thing that's in the bill, because we've talked about it probably 5-10 times this year, is the open MEP provision. It's again in the Republican bill in the House. And kind of building on David's comments, it's clear that the pieces are there for a deal. it's just a matter of getting them together in the right bill. And it's been puzzling why it's been so difficult, because you have kind of RESA, which is something that can get through the Senate. You have this House bill, which can get through the House. And there's a whole lot that they have in common. And there's some provisions that it seems like both sides of the aisle like. So I think as we either go through December or look into next year, it's continuing to have a pretty good likelihood that retirement legislation is going to stay on the horizon.
Go ahead, Kevin. I'm sorry. I think I cut you off. Go ahead.
No worries. The other big issue this week is the kind of pension super committee. So earlier this year, Congress was tasked to figure out a way to save the multi-employer pension system, because kind of it looks like in the next 10 years, the PBGC backstop would run out of money if the current trend lines continue. And the target date was today for them to have a deal. And as recently as last week, there was some hope they were going to get a deal together. It sounded as though there was a proposal that Treasury would make loans to some of these plans, and that there might be other pieces was one way that they might be headed. As of this morning, committee members have indicated that there will not be a deal in time for today's deadline. So there won't be an opportunity for expedited multi-employer pension legislation based on what happened earlier this year. That being said, the super committee members have indicated they're going to continue working together to try to find a solution to the multi-employer pension system crisis.
Well, let's hope that they, you know, we'll give them a little bit more time to take as much as they need to get this thing resolved. There's a lot of people that are relying on these pension plans. We don't want to see them just undercut. And also, we don't want to see the PBGC go bankrupt. That does no one any good. It just means that they're going to raise premium on healthy pension plans. So, you know, a lot of good stuff there, Kevin and David. Thanks so much for sharing that information, and appreciate you always coming on the show and really providing your insights. Hope you guys have a great weekend, and I guess we'll talk to you all again next week.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks, guys. Have a great weekend.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up another great edition of the Weekly Pulse podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. Special thanks to our friend Grant Sabatier, co-founder and creator of Millennial Money, for sharing his insights. And oh, guess what? Grant's going to be joining us each and every week to check in and give us his thoughts on the market and what millennials are thinking. So check us back again next week. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.